I'm actually not really wanting to tell you anything today, but more asking questions, since there's a lot of open issues about our work. To actually generally covariant average metrics within the framework of general relativity. However, my talk here is based on work which is performed with Ian Brown and Georg Bobas from the University of Heidelberg. And in the second part of my talk, I'm going to talk about some work which I did with Professor Otto Nachtmann from Heidelberg and Thomas Dichter from the Institute of Applied Mathematics from the University of Heidelberg. So, at first I'm going to give you a small introduction on the topic itself, and then I'm going to say something about the averaging problem in general relativity and how we can overcome the averaging problem bit within perturbation theory, what the results of that are. Before, in the second part of my talk, I'm going to go to the problem of setting up a generally covariant averaging process and then conclude. Now, as you know, the universe is homogeneous and isotropic on large scales, and therefore we use the Robertson-Walker model to describe the universe, which is a model which is isotropic and homogeneous on constant time surfaces. And that we observe an isotropic spectrum of cosmic microwave background radiation is a good proof for that we can use the Robertson-Walker metric to describe the early universe. And however, there have been small matter inhomogeneities before the time of recommendation, and therefore we can still see some ripples in the CMB angular spectrum, which is a proof of these small inhomogeneities. And to model them, we normally use linear perturbation theory about the Robertson-Walker background. Now, this answers has led to the lambda CDM model, which is in good agreement with all confirmed observations. But to actually explain the galaxy clustering and motions and the gravitational lensing, we need some form of matter which cannot be observed and which makes up 20% of the energy density of the universe, which is called dark matter, and to explain why the universe is flat and currently going accelerating, we need another 76% of the energy density in the form of dark energy with a negative pressure, and only 4% of the energy density are, as you know, in the form of baryonic matter. Now this, or maybe this is too quick. There are some problems about this lambda CDM model. First of all, it is a purely phenomenological model. It doesn't tell us what dark energy and dark matter actually are. And secondly, it doesn't tell us why the dark energy only got important only recently and was very negligible in the early stages of the universe. And this is called the coincidence problem. And now, since the expansion of the universe has started to accelerate just recently, when the structure formation has grown increasingly in nonlinear on small scales, it is only fair to suggest that these two effects are somehow connected, and that the dark energy is only a back reaction effect of the generation and evolution of inhomogeneities on the background cosmology. And well, to find out whether that's true, this leads us to the averaging problem in general relativity. The standard cosmology is based on this equation, where you have on the right-hand side some averaged energy momentum tensor, and on the left-hand side you use the isotropic and homogeneous and averaged out Robertson-Walker metric. But this equation is actually not correct, since the Einstein equations are highly nonlinear, and therefore the average of the Einstein tensor of an inhomogeneous metric is actually not the same as the energy momentum tensor of an averaged metric. And so they don't, these metrics don't evolve in the same way. And this means we are actually using the wrong metric to describe the universe. Now, the correct equations would be an average over Einstein's equations in this form. And what we can do is we can still describe it in terms of the Robertson-Walker metric, but then we'd have to add the difference between these two terms to the right-hand side in form of a modification of the energy-momentum tensor.
The quantum averaging?
Sorry?
The averaging here, what, the quantum averaging or a special?
Just so far, I'm not specified.
But it's quantum averaging.
You're averaging about something, right?
We're averaging about, especially about scales. We are looking at it at large scales. It's a bit like going from Maxwell equations and matter to actually the electrodynamics, where you don't, you know, consider all those small changes in the atoms and still define some macroscopic.
Is it a soft grain averaging then?
It's
a coarse
graining. It's coarse graining, yeah.
So don't worry about the quantum back reaction. That's not true.
Well, you would have to include them as well, I guess. But so far it's not specified. So far it's only like we find the average of the present energy momentum tensor to be the one of the perfect fluid that we use in cosmology.
So you're basically looking at this as a classical problem.
Yes. Yeah, okay. If that was a question, yeah.
Expectation versus state.
So yeah, now the question is how do we find out what this correction terms, like the difference between the two terms, what that is, and what size it is, and if it actually behaves like dark energy, if we can explain dark energy problem at all. Well, the problem about that is that we need to specify what the average is, and that is not really an easy task, because averaging and general relativity is not really well defined, or it's not really straightforward, because you can't compare tensor quantities on different spacetime points that easily, so you can't just define some average. You need to find a way of how to average. And the usual approach to this is it's really easy to define an average over scalar quantities, because scalars are invariant under general coordinate transformations. And so you just decompose Einstein's equations into a set of scalar equations, and then you can average over them pretty easily. So how you do that is you foliate spacetime with a family of space-like hypersurfaces in the usual 3+1 form. Sometimes that's also for ADM formalism. You find some projection operators along the normal of the hypersurfaces with the normal vector defined with a lattice function and the shift vector. And you've got some projection operator into the hypersurfaces. Then you can express the line element in the following way. And moreover, you need the extrinsic curvature tensor, which is defined basically the Lie derivative in the normal direction of the 3 metric of the hypersurface. And for the case that the shift vector is 0, which we can just do because we've got some freedom in the choice of the coordinate system, then you can express it in a very easy way. You also decompose the stress energy tensor, and then you get the Einstein equations in this projected form, namely the Hamiltonian constraint equation and the evolution equation, which are quite complicated. That's like the energy density, the current, matter current, and just the spatial part.
General.
Yeah, that's very general, I think. And then you define the scalar averaging process, like an averaging process for scalars, In this way, we've got the determinant of the free metric. So it is actually generally covariant. And the average of a sum domain with the volume V. And you need to you can define something like the effective Hubble rate in this way with the effective scale factor, which is connected to the domains in that way. And if you do that, the commutator between time and space derivatives, or general scalar function, get some extra terms, which look like this. And they are due to the derivative of determinant of the free metric.
What is alpha?
Alpha is still the Laplace function. And then if you average the two equations, the two Einstein equations, decomposed Einstein equations, you and express them in this effective or average scale factor, then you get to a set of equations which look very much like the Friedmann equation and the Rauch-Dudel equation, for the Robertson-Walker model, but you've got some extra terms here which are a modification of the flat case, so to say, and these modifications are the kinematic effect reaction, the dynamic effect reaction, and the curvature contribution. And so far, the equations called the Buchwald equations, by the way, are still valid for any inhomogeneous metric.
Sorry, but these back reaction terms, do they have anything to do with the averaging procedure? Or suppose
they very much depend on the, I come to this later anyway, but they depend, of course, on the source, on the slicing that you did and on the coordinate system in the domain that you used for everything and all that. So they're not really generally covariant, but that's the best we can do so far.
I suppose, like, if one considered just teaming you with the current term and the Sij term, and one just did the analysis without doing any averaging, will one get the same equations without these rams and caps? Or I just want to understand where does averaging enter?
To get something which is similar to Friedmann equation, Rauch-Dudel equation, the averaging.
So this is an exact equation?
Yes.
So it's just that these terms are
the modifications.
The errors you make by first averaging and then taking some nonlinear expression. So
I think that commutation is part
of the inhomogeneities are coming in into this.
Yeah,
and
they happen due to the nonlinear commutator. Yes?
I've always wondered this, and maybe you know, right? But say I do this, right, with some averaging on some averaging scale, right? And so then I have the Rauch Hilbert equation, disaggregated, and now I average it again on a different, on a larger scale. Does that kind of commute, right? So I start with the exact one, I average, okay, and I average again to a slightly larger domain.
It's like one averaging over a larger domain.
Yeah, so that can be the same answer if I go straight to a larger domain.
I don't know for sure. I could imagine that because, like, of the way you define the effective scale factor,
mm-hmm.
and how you connect it to the volume. So that could be, but I'm not
okay,
sure.
I'm
not sure what anybody has calculated.
Okay, we'll talk about it later.
But yeah, that should actually. Now, as I said, the Buchwald equations are still, they still hold for any kind of metric, but to still find out how large these correction terms are and which sign they have or whatever, we need to specify the equations even further and actually apply to a certain model so that you can find out how they look like.
So far, you haven't said anything whether this Hubble constant that you introduced has anything to do with what we observe, right?
Yes.
So are you going to?
Yeah, that's actually a good point. One of these averaged or effective scale factors is actually observable. Well, but yeah, so to just take a model and see how these equations look like, this specific model, we take some metric in the linear perturbation theory in Newtonian gauge, and connect it to the ADM formalism, and that would set the shift vector to zero. And then we get the Buchwald equations, and calculate the Buchwald equations in this case. But we have to be careful because we later on want to apply it to the Boltzmann codes. And the Boltzmann codes, as in CMBEZ or CMBFAS, they decompose the energy momentum tensor with respect to the fall velocity of some pressureless dust. And now we decompose it with respect to the normal vector for hypersurfaces, and that actually makes an additional change, additional modification of the Buchwald equations, which we call the density correction, which looks like that. And yeah, now we take the domain across which we average the equations large enough to neglect the first order averages, because we think that the background model, the background Robertson-Walker model, is actually defined by the mean of the fluctuations. And then we end up with the modification terms, which are all to second order, and which look like these. And now to calculate them, as I said, we use the CM, Boltzmann codes. We actually use the CMBEZ code, because that's the one with Heidelberg. And that was more easy to access for us. And we use actually the linear theory. So in the linear theory, the different wave modes evolve independently of each other, so we can actually connect the average of all those terms to the primordial power spectrum. And then we use the Poisson equation and the Euler equation to connect the gravitational potential to the matter spectrum. And this is all implemented in CMBEZ already, and so we can calculate the modification terms, and they look like this. And we see that the kinematical modification is pretty negligible, and the others.
If the number, that's a function of k, so how do you plot that? I mean, this is the vector. After you integrate over k, you get one number.
Genau. Yes. We integrated, I think, from scales of 100 megaparsec to the Hubble horizon size.
So, but I mean, is that like the integrand there, what you're plotting up there? Because you have to.
Starting from.
So I should integrate underneath that to get q, or. Or something like that?
No, this is actually plotted over k, so.
I think it's a different redshift. Yes.
No, that's plotted over k. So, base vector logarithmic interval or something like that? It's. And that's the way, I guess.
No, I think we integrated that starting. After inflation.
I realize. So QD is one number, right? It's at any time, it's one number. After you take that integral, you get a number. So what is that number?
The number is, what comes out.
Okay, so
after the integration.
So
This is the measure of Q.
Well, Q, T, P, and like all those modification terms.
But so, QD is a function of K?
QD is a function of K. That presumably is just is the variance of this, you know, sigma 8 for QD, right, or something.
Now, QD is a number. It's not, it's average over the whole space, so it should be.
Oh, right, of course, right, because QD is. It's like QD is like rho, right? It is a number.
That's what I'm saying. It should be a redshift, and that should, the scale should be like maybe the scale of the Hubble range or something.
QD is dependent on the largest scale that you're averaging over. Right? Mm-hmm. So
exactly.
K is now a measure of scale that you're averaging over.
So probably there's a confusion between the K and the horizontal axis and the K and the there. So maybe you're plotting that with the redshifts. You're plotting the number, the integrated number.
It's a bit embarrassing, actually. Let's see.
So is the integral taken from K to infinity?
I guess so, yeah. Yeah. Yeah, and now if you take the modifications of the Friedmann equation and Bajadur equation and interpret them as a cosmic fluid, then you can define some effective density and effective pressure to it, which you can express through the modifications in this way. And you can define an effective equation of state of this cosmic fluid. And calculating that over Z shows a roughly, apart from the slope, but still a roughly constant behavior. And it's of the order of minus 1 over 19. And so.
That is probably average over horizon scale. So.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, minus 1 over 19 is actually too small to be interpreted as a dark energy. And here you've got the changes in the lambda CDM model of the Friedmann equation and Bajadur equation. Here normalized with respect to the lambda CDM model. Now you've got a singularity here which comes from which is exactly at the time when the lambda CDM model started to accelerate, like from this change from this deceleration to acceleration, and that's not really a real singularity. And therefore, if you normalize the changes in the equations with respect to just the matter, then you get this behavior here. And so we see that the modifications stay of the order of 10 to the minus 5. And so within this model, the back reaction cannot explain dark energy. Nevertheless, is a non-vanishing physical effect and should be included in the calculations if you want to match it with the observations. So it's not vanishing. But yeah, as I said, by the way, if you want to know more about this kind of work, my colleague Ian Brown is going to be here in 2 weeks and give a talk as well. And he's going to go into more detail also about what happens if you average in some quintessence universe as well. So if you want to know more details about that, I'll probably ask him. Yes.
So there should be some quantum back reaction. To go back to what Laurent said, so do you have any estimate like if these quantum back reaction effects could actually affect your final like minus 119 factor correct emission?
No, absolutely not. I mean, like, first of all, we did not really feed the back reaction back into the equations. We just estimated, like, we just took linear behavior and estimated the size of the back reaction. And since we there are some issues about the Newtonian metric on small scales. We started at scales like 100 megapascals. So whatever is on smaller scale, no clue.
It's going to be 124 orders of magnitude larger.
When you put this stuff into CMBE, you had to put an averaging scale in there as well, right? So what averaging scale did you put into CMBE?
Well, as I said, we averaged from 100 megaparsec scales to horizon scales.
Oh, I see. Okay, so that's what that plot. Sorry, to back to that plot, but that was the plot where you showed the differences in the physical quantity as a function of what scale you averaged on. That's the idea?
Yes.
I see. So if you ran CMBEC with a smaller averaging scale, right, then you would get these kind of bizarre effects in the sense that, voids would have different expansion rates, right? The W in a void would be different from a W in a filament and so forth. But that you couldn't really pull anything out, like any big differences.
Well, I don't think that's necessarily true. If you look at that plot, you didn't have that. It got very small at large change. We can just show that the plot that you showed us before as a function on KF was very small. So when you see you start at 100 megaparsec as by KF.01, my point is that if you go to larger k, this falls off very fast. So I think it wouldn't make much of a difference if you include, at least in the linear theory, it wouldn't make much of a difference if you include it.
Yeah, sure. But then the problem is that you also observe, the observed metal spectrum actually deviates from.
That could be
correct.
So that would at least enhance it. So if I do CMBEC, right, which averaging scale should I use? Right? You have to choose an averaging scale, right, to define the equations you put into CMBEC.
Ah,
right? Which one should I choose? I don't know quite what physically that decision amounts.
Yeah. Well, the thing is, we couldn't average over larger scales, but the Hubble horizon, of course,
Okay.
Issues. But yeah, definitely.
I guess you want to stay above nonlinear scales.
Yeah.
You want
to see what effect that has.
I
guess. So you should include the smaller scales after all, because this is where back reaction sort of enters the game, I guess.
You would have to use the scale of which the metric form that you've chosen is.
That is, yeah.
Right. So it seems odd, and this isn't a criticism of this work, it's just, in general, I don't quite know what it means to choose an averaging scale to get a different answer, right? So I get a power spectrum, right? And it doesn't fit the data, but if I change the averaging scale, I can fit the data or not fit the data.
Uh-huh.
Doesn't that seem strange? But it seems like averaging scale shouldn't be a physical. In the end, it should all come out, right? There shouldn't be a dependence on averaging scale in CMBEC.
Why not?
Because averaging, it's not a physical process, right? I mean, it's just.
But you want to know. Yeah, you sort of want an effective theory on sort of scale. So you need scale.
So you never use CMBEC to get the power spectrum, for example. CMBEC in the end never gives you a power spectrum.
Uh-huh.
You're just looking at the homogeneous evolution. I see. So in fact, when you do CMBEC, for example, the evolution of the perturbations is not altered.
Yeah.
Right, got it, okay.
Yeah, so that's what I meant by we're using linear theory.
Right, using linear
theory. And we don't feed the back reaction back, we just see what size they are.
Right. I see, got it. So in the end, okay.
So yeah, it could also be, of course, that although at first the deviation is pretty small,
mm-hmm.
If you sort of feed the back range back,
right.
then you get completely different
And so also, I mean,
you didn't prove that that's small.
Right, right, yeah. And then also the other thing you can't measure here is yeah, the idea that there might be a different W in voids versus a, you know, a different W in the filaments.
Right. Yeah, like witches. No.
Right, so that also is, okay, got it, thank you.
No, this is like really just a simple model
yeah.
that
we
could calculate
to see
to do it just to see what's going on.
Yeah.
But yeah, that's...
I think there is a, I don't really want to try, but there's a first order effect that you're ignoring.
Yeah.
And I think that's the effect of the difference between voids mm-hmm. and that. And that could be bigger and small, but that's first order, and that's they're ignoring it because of average that time.
Right,
because normally you believe that the Robertson-Walker background is like where the fluctuations match.
Right. And then, of course, if the evolution is Newtonian, this will come out anyway.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt.
So, I hope I convinced you that the back reaction is not negligible anyway. But yeah, the Newtonian metric is sort of dangerous to use for several reasons. So it's not really... we can't conclude from this that back reaction cannot explain dark energy. We know that back reaction enters at the nonlinear, is a nonlinear effect, and therefore linear perturbation theory is not really adequate. And we know that the averaging process actually highly depends on the choice of slicing that you made, also on the choice of coordinate systems that you use, especially in the domain that you choose. And, of course, cannot be used to average vector or tensor quantities, and they could alter or act as a dark energy as well. So what we actually need to overcome the problem is a generally covariant averaging process. Ah, yeah, also, you can't really know that Robertson-Walker is actually the background that we're thinking of. Maybe, like, there's some different solution now in the later stages of the universe, which is not of Robertson-Walker behavior. So, a general covariant averaging process, we try to set up such a process, but it's got these issues. First of all, we want it to be independent of the coordinate system, obviously, so we need to parallel transport the tensor quantities along geodesics to the same point before we average them. And if you just parallel transport the metric to another point, then you just get the metric and that point because the covariant derivative vanishes. So you can't define a averaging process like that. So we try to overcome this problem by decomposing the metric into a set of tetrads. And this is because if we treat them as pure vectors, then they are sensitive to the curvature they experience along the geodesic. And now we want to find a unique tetrad. We actually want to break gauge invariance because, as you'll later see, the averaging process that we set up is sensible to the choice of tetrad that we use. And to do this, we defined a maximally smooth tetrad field, which is defined to be generally covariant, which is defined by a Lagrangian. And I should point out at this stage that this covariant derivative here does not include spin connection, because we explicitly want to break gauge invariance. So, but apart from that, it's generally covariantly defined. And it's from the idea, it's something like the Fierbein field is to vary as less as possible over the manifold. So we minimize the square of the covariant derivative of it. Well, now we take some domain, which we actually define by taking any point of the manifold. Then we take the bunch of all geodesics in all directions, parametrize them according to the arc length, and cut them off at the same scale, which is like the averaging scale, and then we've got something like a geodesic domain. Now, in this domain, we minimize the Lagrangian that I showed you, and this actually gives us a unique Philbin field, as can be shown. And then we parallel transport the Philbins to the center of the geodesic domain by the use of the Wegener-Wilson line operator, which is just like parallel transporting the vectors along the geodesics. And then we average over the bundle of parallel transported Philbins in the origin. So we transport them all together, average them generally covariantly with an averaging function, which is defined along the geodesic and which falls off to zero smoothly and which is normalized and all that, what normally averaging functions do. And then we get the average metric from that like this. So we just square the averaged Philbin again in the end. Now, this is the idea. No. We treat the Philbin just as vectors.
So just to make very brief some terms. So the problem is, right, so you parallel transport the metric, right, to a new place, right? It doesn't change. So there's, in some sense, not really, it's very hard to average, for example, the scale factor in this generally covariant way. So essentially you create an object at every point that at that point has the same value as the metric at that point, but has different parallel transport properties, such that it's now somewhat non-trivial, right? And these are these E fields. And you use this, you give it a Lagrangian so you know exactly how they kind of smooth out over the domain. Is that correct?
Well, we select this one field in a generally covariant way. Mm-hmm. That was the idea. This is why we use the Lagrangian formulation. Mm-hmm. What that actually means in the end.
I see. Okay.
I don't know.
Right, but like the trick is you need to somehow get a different parallel transport behavior.
Exactly.
And this seems like a nice.
So can I ask another question? Say you start with some general coordinate system in the Minkowski space. Okay, so just do some crazy Fourier transformation and choice of these coordinates, these vectors. Would you get Minkowski after averaging or no?
I don't know, because the averaging process has its problems. Yeah. So I can't actually calculate.
So even if you're starting with Minkowski, you're not guaranteed to get it.
Ah, okay. No. Actually, that as I'll show you, at least in the two-dimensional case, it's going to stay very. But this is actually what comes next. So we started very easily in the two-dimensional case, and we wanted to have some background curvature, therefore we chose the two-sphere, but we did that as far with the plane and the hyperbolic plane, so this goes through just as well. And to have it really easy, we did some stereographic projection to the plane around the south pole, which of course means if I want to average over another point, I'll have to do the inverse projection, rotate the sphere, project it down again, set up the geodesic circle, average over the field, project it back again, have it into the original coordinate system, but at least it's a way to average out the whole sphere. And of course, it's in the symmetric case, it's all the time the same. Well, anyway, so in this projection coordinates, the metric looks like this, where we've got some L squared defined like that. A is the radius of the two-sphere. And the good thing is that the maximally smooth dyad field has a easy, looks pretty straightforward. the geodesics have a really good expression. That's because it's just like straight lines in the projection plane. The connector looks like this. And the result of this is that the average metric is the same as the metric that we started from. So, yeah, so in the case of maximal symmetry, this averaging process does nothing, which is good. That's what we expect from an averaging process. So that's a start. Now we perturb the two sphere a bit. That makes it, of course, difficult because then you actually have to do the projection rotation of the sphere and so on. And yeah, so if we've got a perturbed metric like this, and you want to calculate the maximalism of Bayer field, then yeah, you've got some problems, and we decided that to express it in the following way, the maximalism with Bayer field has to be a rotation of some reference Bayer field, which we just choose arbitrarily, by an angle. That's all that can happen. And so we took the maximalism with Bayer field as a rotation and inserted that into the principle of least action with a Lagrangian. And we introduced some vector field, which is just defined from the reference Bayer field that we defined arbitrarily. And actually, the solution is not dependent on the reference Bayer field. So you can show that if you take another reference field or rotation of that one, then it's just straightforward. So then you get some differential equation with boundary terms on the boundary that you used. And these equations are actually too complicated to be solved analytically already. But there was this colleague from the Mathematical Institute, Thomas Richter, and he's got this toolkit, Gascoigne 3D. And with that, you can solve differential equations or Laplace equations and Newman boundary conditions, Poisson equations, numerically. And yeah, so these are the equations we fed into this program. It's like mathematical details. So the area is given like this. You have to include the perturbation there, perturbation terms. You've got another quantity called V, which pops up here. That's defined by the change of the geodesics due to the fluctuation and all that, but that's all calculable. And this is like a typical answer. I think this was 0.11. So you can see that in the direction of the perturbation, the solution changes, but the away and going looking in the other direction from the perturbation, nothing happens. So this is all well defined. And this is the perturbation function we fed in. This is the perturbation function which came out. So unfortunately, after this whole process, the averaging effect is just too small.
You have the sphere, smooth sphere, right? You put a Gaussian perturbation, right? Then you create the Dyer field, right? The Dyer field, of course, entirely fixed by the metric, right? At every point, has to reduce the metric, right?
Yes.
And then you do the parallel transport. That's why you have to do Gascoigne 3D, right?
Yes.
And then
the Gascoigne 3D thing is to actually calculate the maximalism of Dyer field. We averaged over.
Why do you have to calculate the Dyer field separately if you already know the metric? Doesn't the Dyer field follow?
Because this averaging process depends on the choice of Dyer field that we averaged over.
Okay. Oh, right, because okay.
So we need to pick one specific one.
Mm-hmm.
And this is what we calculated with.
I see, okay.
But still nothing happens. And I know the reason why. Now, there's one diet field that is actually invariant under the averaging, one specific diet field that is invariant as well, and where we have the same problems like with the metric. And that, of course, comes from if you've got the diet in the origin, like any orientation, and then you parallel transport it along the geodesics, then you get a field. When you apply this averaging process, nothing happens. Thus, this is exactly like with a metric, then you parallel transport them back, get just the volume times the diode at the origin, and so the metric is invariant. And this diode field is actually defined by this Lagrangian, where T is the tangent vector along the geodesics, and this is like the Lie derivative. So it's not really a big surprise, because any vector field, if a vector field is parallelly transported along lines where this is the tangent vector, then of course the Lie derivative of the vector field times the tangent vector is zero. So it's not really a big surprise. But this defines the Lagrangian where nothing happens. And our Lagrangian that we use with a maximally smooth diode field is actually just too similar to this one. So the leading term is identical.
Averaging process? I don't know if this is the right moment. Can you perhaps go back to that slide with the circle and where you parallel transport to the center? So if I have you're parallel transporting these, or you're using this V to transport the E's to the center, and suppose now I'm rotate the fear bind, or here the two bind, outside. If I mean I can do these rotations locally in different places around the perimeter. So now I parallel transport them with this gamma to the center. Then the result will be, in general, not just a new vector, right? So somehow the result, the average E, will depend on.
You need to do a global rotation.
Let's say we have these two binds outside, and now I play local gauge transformations. I rotate just the two binds. Now I use your formula, then that gives me a new sum there. And in general, that new sum.
Not
won't,
sure,
won't
because
be
parallel
just
transport doesn't change the angle between the geodesic and the vector.
Yeah, but somehow
so
the,
it
you, the
be
way
just
you
the rotation of the
you, the way you define this parallel transport, it doesn't act on the internal indices at all. So
yeah.
That's what's confusing me. This definition seems to be gauge dependent.
Yes, it has to, because otherwise it wouldn't pick one.
Yeah, but that's physically very weird, isn't it? It depends on how I rotate my two binds out there. I find that very weird physically.
Yeah. Well, me too.
Why,
so I don't know.
This is why you chose that dash for
to pick a specific one.
To choose a specific earline field up to global. So you've broken the gauge
invariance. So you tell me here you've broken the gauge invariance, but then you bring in that action to gain gauge invariance?
No. The action is there to break it explicitly. So decomposing the metric, I can do that like arbitrarily. But since my averaging process depends on the choice of the field, I need to pick one of all the options. One specific field, and this is how the Lagrangian formulation comes in.
So the answer is depending on how you break it, I mean which
yes.
Which particular breaking. So it's not quite covariant, right?
So it's
I'm sorry.
No,
we're almost right out with that.
Oh, I'm very sorry. Sorry. No, I'll hold my question to the end. Sorry.
So yeah, but I am almost there. So yeah, we try to use a different Lagrangian to define this initial tetric field, or diode field actually. So we try to change something here, which depends on the curvature. We try to align the field along the normal vectors of the hypersurfaces. We even try to align it to the geodesic deviations, like psi is like geodesic deviation equation, and we tried some other stuff which I don't want to mention here even. But they all fail to define the dive field, and can be actually used more, which makes a difference, which actually is sensible here. Average, find some average metric. So yeah, and if anybody has an idea of what we can try as well and how this could be changed to give it some insight, we really have to hear something. We ran out of ideas. So yeah, we found a general equilibrium averaging process, and if it's finally working, we've got all the machinery to do the same thing, to calculate how the averaged manifold behaves if I've got one perturbation or two perturbations interacting somehow. We've got all equations actually set up to do the same thing in three dimensions. So along with the ADM formalism, we could actually get some cosmological results from that. In four dimensions, we've got some ideas of how to set that up. Of course, geodesics in four dimensions is something not really straightforward, like the geodesic region that we would average over would be mainly made out of space-like geodesics, and then we've got some boundary problems with the light cones. And yeah, but then in the end, hopefully one day we'll be able to apply the averaging process to cosmology and combine the two lines of research. Thank you. In the first part of the talk, Paul?
Well, yeah, I mean, because the second part is spatial averaging, but, you know.
Yeah, we've heard of that. We've been thinking about it.
But the second part is light cone as well, isn't it? Isn't it along geodesics? I mean, in 3+1 dimension geodesics, I don't like
it. But the surfaces are not defined. You can any surface you want,
yeah.
Right? As opposed to working on a light cone, which is more invariant. Right, so here you have a surface, and the geodesic can actually leave the surface and come back to the surface at a different point.
Get some comments before.
We'll talk more about this afterwards. But it's an interesting question, right? Because this takes us in a totally different direction than I think a lot of the back end people are interested.
Yeah, completely new answer.
Right.
It's just not worth it.
For example, so you have this correct way to average the metric, right? So would you, at the end, you finally pull out a scale factor, right, from this, in the same way the scalar averaging people pull out a scale factor, right? And I mean, are you hoping to somehow get those two scale factors to be the same? Like, are you trying to get a huge global procedure that in certain limits reduces to the standard scalar averaging story? Or do you think that this covariant averaging thing will give you a different answer from scalar?
Well, so the covariant averaging procedure depends, of course, of what you put in. But
what's our procedure?
The general covariant? Are you talking about me?
Huh? I was just comparing, the scalar averaging people eventually come out, for example, with an average scale factor. And you can use the covariant averaging procedure, one day when it works, right, to get out a scale factor. Now, do you think you'll have different answers from the scalar averaging?
No, we don't.
Do you mean, is that the idea? Or?
Yeah, at first we don't really get out a scale factor, but the whole metric, the whole
average
metric. But, of course, if you go to larger and larger domains, you eventually end up with a Robertson-Walker metric. That would actually be an observable.
Right, yes.
On the appropriate. Like, of course, here also depends on the domain of averaging. You have to watch out that the averaging that you do is actually appropriate to what the kind of problems that you are looking at.
Right.
So you want to average out, you know, the fluctuations of galaxies and see how galaxy clusters move on average. Or you go to even larger scales and see how the horizon behaves or whatever. What kind of vectors you get there. So actually it's quite wrong to call it average even because you don't have a background.
Yes, right. I mean, yeah, that's the old choice, yeah.
But yeah, this would be a way to actually get people average metric. And of course, this, like an averaging process, which averages out tensors, can also be used to see what tensor fluctuations would do after all apply to fluctuation theory. Yeah.
So coming back to my confusion from before. So can somebody explain me if the final result, the final average tetrad you get, is independent of the gauge choice or not, and why? So as I said before, it seems to me that this bra e ket is dependent on the choice of the frames. And now, how does that dependence disappear, or does it disappear?
No, certainly the choice that we made somehow shows up in the image.
So is everybody happy with that, or is
to me it gets a bit anti-covariant, right? Like it depends if this is my variable, you know, it depends which one I choose.
To me that seems totally weird. I mean,
what you're doing is you're taking a region and you're doing an average over this region, and now you can do a global Lorentz transformation on this region. So you're taking a coarse grain EUA. And because you're averaging over the whole region, now you have to think of it as a unit.
Mm-hmm. Well, you do, right. So
if you do that for distinct regions, you should be able to construct it. You should be able to see on that larger scale that you still got general covariance, but now your gauge freedom, your local transformations are, you know, rotating this region, rotating that region, and then you can measure between.
So can you show that there remains such a coarse grain gauge invariant?
I think part of that comes back to the earlier question is what happens when you repeat the averaging? If I do the averaging on a small scale and then I want to
I see what you're saying now for the covariant case as well, right? So I mean, I think what you're saying, right, is that, okay, so I pick, you know, I have to pick at some point in the, you know, I have to, my, these E things, I have to pick, you know, which set I use at some point. But that choice is just the same at the end. I'm going to have some metric, it's going to come out. And that metric, of course, you know, is going to be in some coordinate system, just specified coordinate system. So it itself has that same thing. So there's no new, you're not introducing a new covariance gradient.
No, wait a minute. I mean, you can have a metric in several frames, right?
Well, so then the problem comes when you start saying, okay, I do it over this region, now I'm going to shift a little bit. I'm going to do it over the next region. So they're overlapping.
Mm-hmm.
And so you're still going to have to, now you're constructing a smeared.
Right.
Where it's fine at each point. I don't want to have to.
Right. But I think just if you just do one average, one domain, I think this, but yeah, you have to specify this, that field breaks the, you know, spontaneously breaks the symmetry. Right? But in the end it doesn't matter. You just have to break the symmetry in order to do the calculations, because you have to add the different metric components together. Right? But at the other end, right, the symmetry is restored. I think that's true. I mean, I think that's not bad.
I would have to see that in more detail.
Okay, I'm just the founder, right? So I have to trust everyone. So, yeah.
I'm not sure whether the covariance is completely restored. Like the general covariance report, but not the gauge invariance. Because I'd still say the average metric depends on the Lagrangian.
The average depends on the Lagrangian, but not on exactly how the solution to the Lagrangian breaks the covariance.
Yes.
That latter thing, I think, is a very nice property, and almost a necessary property called the covariance.
So can I ask one question? So you're defining average metric in a spatial hypersurface in the second part, is that right?
Well, here, yes, but you can do that in four dimensions as well.
So in four dimensions, so that's like in some domain view, that's average metric in some four dimensional domain. But then how big that domain is, and that's in a sense a gauge dependent on what domain you want to choose.
Yeah.
So that's a gauge dependent. call that.
Yeah, but that's like something that you actually want as well. I mean, like you want to know the average dynamics of matter and homogeneities on different scales. Like you want to see whether you can see small inhomogeneities evolving, or if you want to average that out. So the averaging radius is something that you want. It depends on the Lagrangian, it's probably something odd. There you have to make some sensible choice for ethanol if you try to find any choice. And then we go from there.
This is kind of like in contesting matter, you just have to make a choice. But what scale are we probing the system? Then, mm-hmm. then that tells you what the relevant coarse grain is.
Yeah.
Just like in Wilsonian. Coarse grain or something like that.
Right, coarse grain itself. That's, mm-hmm. Right, but that's we have to. There's no choice. Yeah. You have to pick a frame. You know, what's the lattice? What's your lattice for coarse grain? Mm-hmm.
Right. So there are not any other comments or questions. We should thank our speaker again.